You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 14th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, New York Times reporters Walt Bogdanovich and Michael Forsythe on their book, When McKinsey Comes to Town. Also on the program today, Democrats maintain the Senate majority. Georgia could represent a pickup. It's not over, but it looks like the Republicans will take the House with perhaps one of the slimmest margins ever. 48,000 academic workers start the largest education strike in history across all 10 of the University of California campuses. Meanwhile, the House and Senate back in session today. They've got a lot of stuff to do over the next month and a half. Less, maybe. Funding deadline, December 16th. Want to pass same-sex marriage? Remember, this is the lame duck session. Ukraine aid and maybe the Electoral College reform. Amazon to lay off 10,000 workers this week, as Jeff Bezos says he may give the majority of his $120 billion-plus dollars away. That means that he could be giving almost $70 billion away and keep only 50.
This is the I have so much money I don't know what to do with it besides shoot it into space guy?
Right.
And he says maybe because he's actually going to use that money to buy the Washington Commanders.
And perhaps maybe you could also just, like, I don't know, keep those workers working, or just give the money to the U.S. government. Meanwhile, former Trump chief of staff John Kelly reveals that Trump wanted the IRS to target his enemies. And he also reveals once again that John Kelly is still a scumbag. Three dead in a UVA mass shooting. HarperCollins workers strike, and Joe Biden meets with Xi at the G20 in Indonesia. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday. Thanks so much for joining us. Here, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello.
I should say, and let's just get this out of the way, Fun in Portland wrote, looking sharp with that supercut, Sam. Look, I am not happy with my haircut. All right? I'm not happy with it. It's too short. I was specific with the barber lady person, the haircut specialist.
Hmm.
Just take a little bit off. It's just getting a little bit bushy in the back, and that's it. And then all of a sudden, it's like when you're a hammer, everything's a nail.
Right.
And I don't know why you can't just do a trim.
What specifically is bothering you about it?
I don't, oblongness.
Yeah, it's just I don't like it. I don't like any part of it. So
it makes me uncomfortable looking at it.
Matt like was like at first like, no, I don't see what's wrong. And then he's, oh yeah, no, I get it.
Now
he's obsessed with it.
When you're drawing attention to it, it's hard for me not to see it. It looks like you're wearing a wig playing yourself in the show.
It does, right? All right. God damn it. This is going to take a couple of weeks. Folks, I'm going to probably be just audio today. And maybe for the next couple of days, we'll just do an animated version of me.
I mean, you should just do like other podcasters do and wear flat-brimmed hats.
That's what I'm going to be wearing.
You know, and you're a comedian, so you have to do it.
Pork pie hat, maybe for me. For
a Carhartt beanie or something.
How about a newsboy cap? Hey, a little bit of flair.
Well, that was the other thing. That was the other thing. I wore, it was cold. I wore a beanie today, and that may be also messing with it. So
I'd like Sam wearing a newsboy cap, starting the show off with extra. Extra.
Me too.
Okay. All right, here we go. Now I've unleashed the on the IMs, and that's a huge mistake. All right. So, folks, over the weekend, as you probably know, the final nail in the Republican Senate aspirations coffin was Catherine Cortez Masto winning in Nevada. Georgia remains, in my opinion, extremely important for both for defensive and potentially offensive reasons in terms of legislation. From a defensive standpoint, if the Republicans take the House, which looks increasingly likely at this point, then you have one vote margin in the Senate. And someone like Kristen Sinema, and I know I've been told this in a couple of times, that it would not make sense for her to do this calculation based upon what happened in Arizona. But I look at her and think she can't possibly think she has a future in Democratic politics. And but maybe in Republican politics, who knows? And that wouldn't necessarily happen in the first couple of days. I think Jim Jeffords, waited through half of his half of a term or a year into and Spector may have too, although he was a little bit quicker. And remember, she's got a lot of friends in the Republican Party. That's the way this happens. The story we would read in Politico, in a year, if Kristen Sinema flips, is she had built a great relationship in the when forging the Portman Sinema bill with one of these senators. And
I mean, she's going out saying I love Mitch McConnell, we're great friends, speaking at his conference.
McConnell was like a dad to me, and he came to me. I mean, who knows what the story would be. So Georgia becomes very, very important for the Democrats. And it's hard to imagine that there's this going to be this level of urgency with the Republicans. And again, as I've been saying, I think there was a lot of people who came out to vote against Stacey Abrams in that a tremendous amount, but a significant amount. I mean, there was a big, obviously a big disparity between what Kemp got and Herschel Walker got. And so I think the favorite in this instance is Warnock. But this is only 3 weeks away now.
And the early voting window is a lot shorter than it was for the other, for like the regular midterm election. And people are going to have off in the days before the voting starts, which is Monday the 28th, the Monday after Thanksgiving. So the likelihood that people will be able to take off work after maybe having off for Thanksgiving is slimmer. Meaning just, that early voting is probably going to be a little bit less.
Who's getting work off on the Monday after Thanksgiving?
Nobody. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, nobody around here, too.
Well, yeah.
All right, but be that as it may. It's my birthday.
That's right. The 28th.
I should take that off.
Oh.
We have to work on Sam's birthday.
Well, yeah, of course. Double show on that day.
And so libertarian callers, please.
Exactly.
Please.
All libertarian call show.
We call them.
Let's get it. Exactly. Actually, that's actually a good idea. My birthday special is me calling into libertarian shows. All right. Let's get to this. The Donald Trump is scheduled. Everybody seems to think he's going to announce tomorrow. And there is look, I don't want to oversell this because I have seen this way too many times where it appears like there's these, big fights that are brewing in the Republican Party. And the end of the day, of the two parties, fights and divisions exist for about for virtually no time in the Republican Party, because to a large extent, there is no ideological differences. There's barely any. There's very little. Like, there's just no diversity. You can't find a more homogenous group of people than the Republican Party. They are beyond overwhelmingly white. In terms of an electoral base, they are also overwhelmingly male. And in terms of financial interest, even if you look at the electorate, they tend to be wealthier than Democrats. And the electeds all have one agenda, and that is to get tax cuts, essentially, to rich people. So their divisions do not last very long. It really just has to do with where are my best interests served? And that's it exclusively within the Republican Party.
Plus, they have an authoritarian mindset. So once the big guy kind of becomes the leader, the top king ape or whatever, then they all kind of
exactly
bow down.
They fall into line. Yeah. And so, you know, there's this big DeSantis Trump thing brewing. I'm convinced it's going to take about a week, and everybody will come into line from Trump after he announces. There's also this McConnell, Rick Scott thing brewing, I guess. McConnell's going to stay on because Rick
Alien
Scott's
versus
a moron.
Predator.
And this, what's that?
Alien versus Predator.
Exactly. Exactly. And Kevin McCarthy, I think he's going to hang in there in the House because nobody else wants that job. Nobody else is dumb enough to want that job.
With like a 3 or 4 seat Republican majority. That
there was
is
three
gonna...
people, three lawmaker, House members who died in the last 2 years. So having a 3 seat majority is no walk in the park. Here is Chuck Todd, you know, doing his best to seem like he's probing in any questions that he's offering to this to Senator Bill Cassie, Republican from Louisiana.
If this is the result of these elections, but the Republican Party still has sort of the same leadership at RNC, Ronna McDaniel, Kevin McCarthy of House Republicans, Mitch McConnell of Senate Republicans, and of course, Donald Trump is sort of the leader out there. If there's no change there, do you think that's a problem for Republicans going forward?
First, we're not a cult. There's one person who leads our party. If we have a city.
Pause it for 1 second. You know, one of the ways that you can tell if a group of people is a cult, and that is if they just feel like we've got to make it clear we're not a cult, regardless of what I'm being asked.
Bullet point number one.
It's like,
right.
It's like you being asked a question about, you know, how's the majority report doing? First
we're
of all,
not a cult.
No. And you going, first of all, my haircut's great.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
No, that's on your mind, not everybody else's.
Exactly. you should know, they're not a cult. Definitely not a cult.
Ronna McDaniel, Kevin McCarthy of House Republicans, Mitch McConnell of Senate Republicans, and of course, Donald Trump is sort of the leader out there. If there's no change there, do you think that's a problem for Republicans going forward?
First, we're not a cult. We're not like, okay, there's one person who leads our party. If we have a sitting president, she or he will be the leader of our party. But we should be a party of ideas and principles. And that's what should lead us. And I will go back. What we've been lacking, perhaps, is that fulsome discussion followed up with the policy initiatives that we work to pass that will define who we are. Again, we are not going to have one person anointed unless she or he happens to be a sitting president. We should have a set of principles and ideas and legislative accomplishments that is our lodestar, if you will. That's where we need to go.
I understand that's where you should go. How do you get the party there?
All right, pause. Wait a second. The follow-up question to this is, you guys were in power for 4 years. What legislation did you pass? Tax cuts. Anything else? Well, you've been out of power for 2 years. Who else has emerged as a leader? Nobody. I got news for you. You're a cult.
Yeah, you used to talk about repealing.
By your own definition, you're a cult. You basically said, we're not a cult. Because if we were a cult, we would do exactly what we've done for the past 6 years. And we've done that, so we're not a cult.
What was the Republican Party platform in 2020?
Yeah, it was everything that Donald Trump wants. In fact, there wasn't one.
No.
They didn't even pull one out.
Right.
Like, ask Trump.
You know how hard it is. You know the base of this party still loves Donald Trump. Or do you think that this midterm could break that spell?
You know, elections are about winning. And so if folks want to look at these election results and decide that's where you want us to continue to be, then we're not going to do well. If people are going to look at these election results and say, hey, listen, the Republicans have established themselves, ourselves, as the anti-woke brand. We care about being anti-woke. Now let's have a series of policy initiatives that actually help people's lives get better.
Okay, so just in case you were wondering, what is the policy prescriptions of Senator Bill Cassidy to prove that they're not a cult? It is, we're the party of anti-woke.
Yeah,
can we just like sit for a moment with that? That a grown, frickin' adult senator just said, we're going to come up with policy prescriptions that say that we're not we're anti-woke. First off, there couldn't be more evidence on how their transphobia fell flat on its face. It turns out that the American public, I mean, if you put the question right in front of them and they've got to decide, like, what's going to happen with women's sports, they might decide, like, okay, yeah, no trans women in women's sports, maybe. Like, they don't know how to answer this. But in terms of like what they actually care about, they don't care, because normal people don't really care. I suppose if you've been training, for sports for a long time, and you're worried that you're not going to win, you know, you could possibly be upset about trans people in sports. You could also possibly, hire two guys to take a lead pipe to your opponent and take her out of the running. I mean, who knows what you could do? But normal people just sort of realize, like, it really doesn't impact me if someone is uncomfortable with the gender that they have been in, and they've gone through all sorts of therapy, and they've tried everything they can do, and they want to live a happier, more fulfilled life, and they do this. It really doesn't in any way really implicate my life in any way.
Yeah, I'll let the school athletic board deal with that, and I'll vote on, you know, abortion or something. Like
exactly.
That.
Something that maybe involves, like, you know, rights for 50% of the country at a minimum.
State GOP chief of staff running against Whitmer, for Tudor Dixon, said there were more ads on transgender sports than in inflation, gas prices, and bread and butter issues that could have swayed independent voters.
And Michigan, I got news for you. Like, Michigan is ripe for the taking for the Republican Party. And the idea that they got completely blown out there, and Kennedy is going on TV and going, like, we're not a cult. We're just going to come up with policy positions to be the anti-woke party?
Yeah, and frankly, like, I know that media critique, again, it can be lazy, but why is that not Chuck Todd's first question, as opposed to, like, okay, I want to goad you into a soundbite being anti-Donald Trump? Like, what are you actually proposing?
Because all they can think is, like, this is the Trump story. So you have the entire Republican Party saying, like, the problem is Trump, and that Trump's in the way of us doing the anti-woke stuff. Like, yeah. No, guys.
Right, not... right.
And also, okay, let's say you got rid of the entire Republican leadership. What's going to change?
Nothing.
I mean, maybe their skill sets might change a little bit, but it's only going to go down. You're not going to find anybody who is more successful at being the Senate majority leader than or minority leader than Mitch McConnell.
Rick Scott would just be more explicit about taking away and cutting into Social Security and Medicare.
That's just going to
be literally
worse.
Their one problem, yep, with him was that he was way too open about, oh, we're going to raise taxes on everybody who isn't rich with my new plan.
Crazy.
So that's why they can't be specific. And it's helpful to them that nobody seems to ask them that question.
In a moment, we're going to be talking to Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth. They're investigative reporters with the New York Times. They have written a new book, When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. Just a couple of ads first. One of our sponsors today is Hold On Bags. We've been talking about these.
50% of the world's plastic, I think it is now, has been produced in the past 18 years. We have a massive plastic problem, and it doesn't go away. Huge plastic island in the Pacific. And part of that, 100 billion plastic bags are used and then thrown away every single year. There's a better way, and it's called Hold On. Hold On is a company born from the idea that there has to be a better way to go about our daily chores. Trash bags and kitchen bags are obviously necessary staples, but do they need to be 100% plastic? Well, the answer is 100% no. Hold On trash and kitchen bags are a heavy-duty, plant-based, non-toxic. They're 100% home compostable. Compostable? Compostable. Compostable. Which means that they break down in weeks, not decades. So you don't fill up landfills. You don't pollute our oceans, et cetera, et cetera. Their Zip Seal kitchen bags come in sandwich or gallon size sizes to fit your needs, from holding carrots to crayons or whatever. Here is a little sandwich one, because I haven't seen anything like compostable with a zip thing.
Oh, yeah.
Here it is. It's like this. Super easy. Put your sandwich in there. Bingo, bango. Or your carrots, maybe. I don't know. My kids don't eat carrots. Kids don't eat vegetables.
Apple slices.
Apple slices, strawberries. There's a, I mean, look, you can figure it out. You know what to put in a bag.
Right.
The point is that Hold On wants to be part of the growing movement away from single-use plastic. And again, you don't need to go far to find out how problematic plastic is around just the world. Hold On bags are on a mission to make daily chores something you can feel good about, one bag at a time. To shop plant-based bags and replace single-use plastics all over your home, visit holdonbags/majority or enter majority at checkout. You save 20% off your order. Sustainability has never been more simple. That's holdon, H-O-L-D-O-N, bags.com/majority or enter majority to receive 20% off your order. We got trash bags over there, too. We got the bigger zip tie bags. They got all sorts of bags, so check it out. HoldOnBags.com/majority. Small things can lead to lasting change if we stop and say, hold on, I can do better than that. I just added that other part about it. It's true. What do you want me to tell you? This is great. This is a really great product. And when you get to be my age and you're in the sandwich generation as it is, you got the kids on one side, you get the parents on the other, you begin to appreciate these things more and more. This is a great gift for holidays. I mean, it's a great gift, frankly, at any time. You should do this. It is it's a service product called StoryWorth. StoryWorth is an online service, like I say, that helps you and your loved ones preserve precious memories and stories for years to come. Every week, StoryWorth emails your relative or your friend or whoever it is you've decided, it could theoretically be your child too, actually, which is not a bad idea, actually, now that I think about it, but a thought-provoking question of your choice or from a vast pool of options. And they do this automatically. You don't have to do it. You can set it up and just let it go. Each unique prompt asks questions that you've probably never thought to ask, like, you know, what's the bravest thing you've ever done in your life? Or even like, what was your favorite car? Or, you know, I don't know, where was your first puppy? Or something like that. I mean, just sort of innocuous questions that get people thinking, and you don't know where they're going to lead. So after 1 year, StoryWorth compiles all of your loved one's stories, and then including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that you're able to share and revisit for generations to come. When you read the stories, you can also read them on a weekly basis. It helps you connect with your loved ones. But again, it also just becomes like a great record of their life. It gives people the sense to reminisce. I mean, this is honestly like one of those gifts that has value to the person that you're giving it to, has value to you, has value to your kids, has value to your relative. I mean, it really is. It's a great idea. And, so keep that in mind, and believe me, you want to do this sooner rather than later. It is a gift that is both personal and fun also too, in many respects. Go to storyworth.com/majority. You'll save $10 on your first purchase. That's storyworth, Bankofamerica.com/majority to save $10 on your first purchase. It's a great thing to get for your parents. All around, I honestly can't. I can't impress upon you that enough. And do it quick. Also, another thing that is good to do if you're worried about your online privacy, or you're worried about your ID, someone stealing your ID, or if you're like me and you've gone through this, it was very difficult at one time to find a convenient way to control what your kids consume in terms of like their digital devices. One of the things that Aura does, and Aura does a lot of different things, is it allows you to manage what your kids can do on their devices easily. You can restrict specific apps. You can put on screen time limits. You can even set focus time to ensure that your kid is, you know, doing their homework on their digital device instead of, I don't know, looking at YouTube videos about how, you know, different actors fall downstairs or something like that. Fake, you can't believe what's going on there. Anyways, but Aura is a great app that does that and more. Aura helps you fight back against those websites that make your personal information public by automatically requesting removal of your info. This helps reduce robocalls. It also keeps your online persona private. Aura protects you from scammers and hackers by scanning the dark web. See where criminals have stolen your information. You plug in your emails and your family's emails. You put in your passwords, your social security numbers. It alerts you if it finds anything that lets you know, like, I got to change my password, or maybe there's been a security breach here. Aura gives you real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, or near real-time alerts, like if someone's trying to open a loan or a credit card in your name. Or it's got a VPN that allows you to stay anonymous while you're surfing online. Aura protects your devices from viruses and malware and spyware. All sorts of things like that. And like I say, they also can help you manage your kids' devices. And here's a tip. Do it from the beginning so that the kids like ultimately will find out you're doing it. But you just like, just that's in general, all parenting. Don't let your kids do anything until they're way older than you would imagine that they'd do it. Just save yourself the headache. Believe me. I don't care what it is. Don't even let them know that soda exists until they're like 22. Or it's got a password manager too that lets you store and access your online passwords securely and conveniently. You can try Aura for free for 14 days at aura.com/majority. When you put in your email, just to see what's out there, you're going to be shocked at how much your private information Aura finds exposed online over the next 2 weeks during your free trial. That's A-U-R-A, aura.com/majority. Try Aura for free for 14 days. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth, they're investigative reporters with the New York Times. For 5 years, they have been investigating McKinsey and have written a book, When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. You're going to find out why it took 5 years of investigative reporting to find this stuff out. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome to the program Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth. They are investigative reporters at the New York Times, and they have written a book, When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Walt, let me start with you. You guys spent basically 5 years working on this book. You're investigative reporters. Why was that important when you're talking about something like McKinsey? Because they seem to be everywhere, but they're also, it turns out, to be incredibly secretive.
Well, they're very big and very powerful, and as you pointed out, and we pointed out, very secretive. But even more important, there is no accountability with McKinsey or with consultants because there's no regulation. Now, that wouldn't matter if they were some small town outfit, but they advise most of the major 500 companies. They advise governments around the world, dictators, all on down, and the public doesn't know anything about them. And when we started looking at them, we knew it was a tall order because their entire business model is based on secrecy. They really, you know, brand into the brains of every recruit. You don't talk about your clients. You don't say who they are, and you don't say how much they're paying them. So we knew we were up against it, but, you know, we thought we were up to the challenge. And, you know, investigative reporters are supposed to look at power centers that have no accountability, and we did.
Michael, the other sort of, I guess, part of the brand of McKinsey, maybe the fundamental brand of McKinsey, at least in terms of like what is forward facing, is that they have morals or values, that they're, you know, almost like a values first company. Talk about what those values are and how the existence of those values ultimately allowed you guys to pierce the sort of veil of secrecy that they have.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of companies have mission statements and values, and they talk about this stuff. But, you know, ask an employee at those companies what they are, and they probably couldn't say. But at McKinsey, they actually take this stuff seriously. People know about these values and talk about them and cite them, and they're cited throughout our book. And what's interesting about the values is the order that they are written down. And the first value, you know, inevitably in any list in a McKinsey office, and they're usually posted, you know, in the entryway, the lobbies there, is to put the client's interests above the interests of the firm. Other values, you know, are, you know, to act with integrity. There's an interesting one, an obligation to dissent. If you disagree with something, you speak out. All these values really played in to our book because a lot of, you know, one of the things McKinsey is very successful at is recruiting. They do a great job of getting some of the best and brightest, you know, the smartest people from, you know, Ivy League or, you know, Oxford, Cambridge, those types of places. And the way they can get some of those people into the firm, rather than having them go to some other competitor or something, Goldman Sachs or, you know, Blackstone or someplace like that, is that they appeal to their idealism that, you know, at McKinsey, you can change the world. You can really make a difference. And when they get there, inevitably, some of them realize that that's not what their work is all about. And that's when the obligation to dissent comes in. They speak out, and, you know, we were very fortunate in many of them came to us.
Well, okay, let me, I want to ask you, well, let's start with that, with the obligation to dissent, only because in terms of what it does for you. When they come to you, have they dissented at the company and found like, oh, you can dissent, but it doesn't really mean anything? Is that it, Walt?
Not necessarily. In fact, I would think in the majority of cases, that's not what happens. I think the times they call us is because I think they know what's going to happen. They know what the response is going to be. Maybe historically they've done it. But the point is that, you know, there are senior partners who are making multi-millions of dollars, and they need this revenue to keep coming in. And, you know, they're going to dissent on, you know, they don't want dissent, but they say they do. And I think what Mike mentioned, where their biggest trouble came in, was the first value, which is basically to do what the client wants. And if the client wants to sell more cigarettes, sell more cigarettes. If the client wants to sell more opioids in the middle of the opioid epidemic when tens of thousands of people are dying, then we'll help them sell more opioids. If the company wants to, to sell more vaping devices to younger people or not pay enough attention to that, well, then McKinsey will be there to help them. So that's where they get into trouble. And I think it's sort of inevitable that they would if they always follow that, you know, client comes first.
Well, you know, that was that's the one that is such a weird value, because when you say was going to be my next question, when you say a client over the firm, it sounds like, wow, that's a lot of integrity, like the client's interests over the firm. But then you start to break it down, Michael, and you start to realize, wait a second, that's not good, right? I mean, like it sounds like it would be good. Like, we're not here for us. We're here for the people that we serve. But then you start to realize, like, what would it mean if you put that in practice? It would only mean, like, we have integrity and there are certain lines we won't cross. But it's basically like saying, like, we'll do anything that you guys want us to for money on some level, right?
That's right. And that's our book, you know, in a nutshell, I think. And we wouldn't write the book if McKinsey didn't make a big difference. But, you know, like I said, they employ some of the smartest people in the world who will work their tails off for their client. And in many cases, as we outline in the book, those clients are bad actors at some time. You know, whether, you know, it's Purdue Pharma, you know, marketing opioids, or an authoritarian regime abroad or a corrupt government.
So I guess I am curious, big picture, about consulting and kind of the history of it more broadly, if we could just zoom out for a second. And what I mean, you talk about how they McKinsey says, you know, put the client first above everything. But, you know, what they do for clients, as you say, is, you know, allow to maximize shareholder value by consulting and ensuring that certain products are profitable, et cetera. It almost seems like another step in kind of neoliberal capitalism and like having this third party acting as, I don't know, just another step in the removal of these corporations from their actual clientele.
I'd like to make two points on that. Number one, one of the main reasons that corporations or even governments hire McKinsey is to give them cover for the bad decisions that they want. And McKinsey will do that since client interests always come first. That's the first important thing. And second thing is, I think one of the great dangers that we were able to dig into and look at is how government is outsourcing so much of its business, of its responsibilities, the taxpayers' fund, outsourcing it to consultants who really have no obligation to disclose what they're doing or how they're doing it. And they have resisted efforts by journalists like Mike and me to uncover that. And I think that's really dangerous in a democracy, and it's worrisome because governments have a responsibility to, I mean, they don't trust their own staffs to do this work, or they should. I'll make another point is government gets beaten up all the time. And it's led to, you know, loss of faith in government. And I think that's really kind of tragic. Government needs to be exposed when they do something wrong. But we're not kidding ourselves. The real power in this world, the real power in the United States is in the corporate suites. And McKinsey is there, both feet planted in there, and that's important to know.
It does feel that McKinsey has played an outsized role in the, I mean, you know, there's capitalism, and then there's capitalism that becomes like even more predatory, and it feels like that the corporate structure in and of itself is set up to function as a way of separating the individual from the consequences of the decisions that they make. And McKinsey feels like it is some type of like hyper lubricant for that process. And you guys really outline it. I mean, you've mentioned a couple of these situations, and let's talk about some of the specifics here. I mean, we could start with Walmart. And, you know, I've been doing this long enough that I remember talking about Walmart, I guess, maybe 10, 15 years ago, when the issue was that they were explicitly relying on the safety net, you know, things like food stamps and Medicaid, to subsidize essentially their hiring of workers. I'm not, you know, I as a political matter, like I think government should do this broadly speaking, but you guys write that this was almost like a strategy that was basically brought to them by McKinsey. Is that right, Michael?
It is, but I would actually go way farther back than, you know, Walmart, you know. So back to 1950, you know, when Sam Walton was just starting his five and dime stores in Northwest Arkansas, you know, McKinsey was hired by General Motors to do a study of executive compensation. And McKinsey got access to and looked at companies, you know, around the United States and started broadcasting this information about CEO pay, executive pay, and also found something very interesting that it looked like workers' pay was actually growing at a faster rate than executives' pay. My God, you know, it's shocking. And this is the result of, you know, the unionization, you know, after the 1930s, you know, during the 1930s. And so, boy, McKinsey solved this problem, you know. This information, you know, about CEO pay spread, you know, via Harvard Business Review, Fortune magazine, written by a McKinsey consultant, Arch Patton. It got around and CEO pay started increasing. It was a genesis of that back, you know, more than 70 years ago. And, you know, you said it was a lubricant. What McKinsey consultants have told us is, you know, McKinsey is an accelerant of these big ideas, you know, shareholder capitalism being one of them. And because of its connections to the C-suites, you know, in all these corporations, it can spread these ideas really quickly. And, you know, I'm sure Walt could talk a little bit more about Walmart as well.
Yeah. And Walt, and focus on this idea, too, that I think Michael is alluding to, that like there's. You know, McKinsey is presumably hired by the people in the C-suite. Mm. And so, you know, and what has increasingly happened over the past 40, 50 years in corporate America is that the members of the C-suite have almost started to create like these cottage industries where their compensation and what they make is not necessarily aligned with the success long term of the company. And so in addition to sort of like focusing on shareholder value, they're some of the biggest shareholders. And when we have this sort of notion of a company that is like, we care about the community, we care about our workers, you know, that we're, you know, this town, you know, functions because of this factory. Those McKinsey people are coming in and their clients are perhaps more narrow in the interest of their clients are more narrow than maybe they would let on.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, they've shown year after year after year that their interest is in helping shareholders, you know, make more money, and in doing so, the CEOs, you know, are going to keep their jobs. The corporate structure changed over obviously since the 1950s, and McKinsey played a big role in that. There was a time when, you know, there was a permanence to a corporation. Workers knew that if they did their jobs, they would gain entry to the middle class, and they did. And the companies knew that if they treated their workers reasonably well, they would have a steady workforce. Well, over time, that totally changed. And McKinsey played a role in that, in making the corporations more ephemeral, more, you know, profits today are more important than profits tomorrow. Profits today are more important than helping the community or developing a product that is really going to help society. So that's where they kind of got lost. And that led them into doing things like offshoring and outsourcing. And they made the point of that this is really not going to hurt anybody. It's good for society as a whole. I think they even said it gives everybody a bigger piece of the pie. I mean, you can have people in India making money and people in the United States making money. Well, that's true. But the casualties, and they almost never mention the casualties, are the workers and the communities in which they live.
One of the things that fascinates me is and part of a function of their secrecy is that you have them and they brag that they will work for your competitors, right? They'll say this too. And, mm-hmm. and again, like that to me is not necessarily inconsistent with the idea that we're going to make you guys in the C-suite money. That doesn't necessarily mean your company is going to thrive per se. It's just that we're going to figure out, because, you know, when we talk about shareholders, it's not just that those C-suite people keep their jobs. That's how they get paid largely now, particularly, you know, since the, you know, the Reagan era with the changes in capital gains taxes becomes a much better way of getting paid than actually getting paid by the company. You do it in the form of shareholder value because they're major shareholders. But the thing that becomes really problematic is that they, or even worse in my mind, is they're both advising the regulators and those that are regulated. Michael, talk about supposedly the supposed firewall that exists there in between, you know, the guys who are working for the opioid manufacturers, Purdue, let's say, and let's say the FDA. Or and we should also mention, which I did not know, that they are part of these municipal and state settlements. McKinsey had to pay off like $600 million, was it, for this? I mean, that's but talk about that dynamic, broadly speaking.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things we are lucky and fortunate in is getting a real look at a McKinsey's client base. You know, it's client lists and an idea of who its biggest clients were. And inevitably, you know, what pops out is managed care, healthcare, big pharma. This is really, you know, and I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb here, Walt, is the really bread and butter of McKinsey earnings. You know, of course, they're working for banks, for oil companies as well. And so what we found is, you know, McKinsey's advising, you know, most of the big pharmaceutical companies in the United States, you know, companies like Johnson & Johnson, the big managed care companies, the big hospital companies, and they're also advising the FDA. They're advising, or had until just last year, advised the big tobacco companies, Altria, British American Tobacco, all those companies, and at the same time advising the FDA. Now, of course, McKinsey says that, you know, there is a firewall and that they don't advise the FDA on specific matters, you know, pertaining to those specific companies. But what we're finding out this year, you know, through even more documents and hearings is that, you know, actually, in some cases, the same people who were working for companies like Purdue Pharma, you know, were also going over and working for the FDA. These are McKinsey people working on, you know, the FDA, the McKinsey project at the FDA. So in some instances, it's the same people.
That seems yeah. very not firewall-y to me.
It's not. And it's probably one of the main reasons that they had to pay more than $600 million to settle government investigations into their involvement in the opioid crisis. But I want to make a point there as well, that they seem to take the view that they could buy their way out of trouble by paying this money, because they always append the statement, well, we did no wrongdoing. We weren't involved in any law breaking, but we're paying more than $600 million, even though we didn't do anything wrong. It's the same statement that they made in South Africa, where I went and reported on their activities there, where they had to pay back more than $100 million in a country that it's the income inequality is among the worst in the world. And they had to pay that back. But they also said, but we didn't do anything wrong. Now, I think reasonable people hearing that, and I like to think most people are reasonable people, they would think, well, that doesn't make any sense. If you did nothing wrong, why are you paying all that money?
I mean, it's the cost of doing business, I would imagine, you know, that they, this is just another line item, like, you know, the, whatever, the
buying their way out of trouble is what they're doing.
Well, Michael, I mean, what, I mean, let's talk about that sort of like, I mean, obviously, you know, obviously there's no firewall if it's the same person. I would argue that it's also sort of hard to say that there's a firewall if presumably these McKinsey people, like, I mean, so, okay, walk us through this process, because I'm curious, and this also deals with some antitrust issues that I want to talk about too. But Do they all gather in some type of like, I don't know, big auditorium? And if you're involved in healthcare, let's say, are there broad concepts that they're like, who trains these people? And are they on the same page in terms of certain sort of like philosophical approaches to say like pharmaceuticals? So if, you know, I send, you know, Betty to the FDA and Billy to the pharmaceutical company, they're coming from the same perspective, which I would imagine is all pro-business, right? Like Betty's not sort of like a gung-ho FDAer. I was going to go into the FDA, but then I decided to go to McKinsey. Like, aren't they already just sort of, I don't know, satellites of the same mothership anyways? And they all have the same, I don't know, you know, sort of MO DNA in their heads, that if it's applied to the FDA and it's applied to some pharmaceutical, that the answer is going to ultimately lead to the same destination?
I think I would disagree with that. I think, you know, a lot of McKinsey people, you know, are not neoliberals, believe it or not. I think, you know, the company itself certainly over the decades has espoused the idea that, you know, the private sector has lots of solutions that can be used to help companies. But I don't think they all get into a big room and get neoliberal programming and big business programming. And, you know, this is how, you know, we're going to approach a problem. There is a lot of training at McKinsey, but it's also an extremely stovepiped organization, and stovepiped because of the secrecy. So, you know, I think what, you know, I think one of the things that gets them in trouble is the absolute zeal that they have going into work on a client project, and they forget the forest for the trees. They're working so hard to serve the client, and, you know, and they get caught up in that. And I think also a lot of times they lack an emotional quotient. You know, they've got all the IQ, but they're missing the EQ. So the problem, you know, often just manifests itself down on a micro level, on a project level. Well, you may not disagree. You may not agree with me on that, though.
Or I gently disagree with you, Mike, on
okay.
that.
Okay. Yeah.
Because
this is what Mike, I was here. This is what I'm here for, guys.
Yeah, that's right. My big interest, really, over my lifetime as an investigative journalist, is healthcare. It affects us all, obviously. That's the cliche. And McKinsey is a believer in the free market system, survival of the fittest. And so, you know, they see a role in government mainly as a way for them to get business. But they believe that ultimately that the companies are going to triumph and should triumph, and the government should have as little involvement as possible. Except,
so how do you send someone over to the FDA with that ideology? Are they coming in and saying like, well, for efficiency's sake, let's let all of the pharmaceuticals, and I know there's not the resources to do this on the FDA side, but, you know, it's also a question of like how good you feel about that. Let's do all self-reporting on this, or let's loosen the regulations for, let's say, McKesson and CVS when they distribute these pills. And they don't necessarily need to have the same benchmarks for this or that, you know, would hold them accountable. I mean, what does the person who gets sent to the FDA, are they just like, we've got to tear into these corporations? Or are they like, well, we can make things more efficient if we...
Efficiency is their calling card. And one of the big bragging points that they aren't shy about spreading when they want government contracts is that they say that we've done all this great work for these companies and for these insurers, for these drug companies. I lost my train of thought there for a second. Sorry.
Well, efficiency being key, I mean, it works not just for, I guess, making money in the short term, but also just the general concept of having consultants helps them kind of cut down, maybe, and I guess I'm curious about your guys' thoughts on this, on their long-term costs with their own in-house labor force, right? Because when you outsource this to McKinsey and to consulting firms, you don't have to worry about people climbing the ladder and getting paid more money long term, right? It can be more of the guys in the smoke-filled room making some of these decisions, outsourcing it to McKinsey with a one-time fee, as opposed to, say, having this all be in-house and promoting people from within, which might be less efficient to the for the people at the top.
McKinsey's very expensive. So I think, a firm that hires McKinsey to solve all sorts of problems, you know, you're rapidly going to ring up millions and millions of dollars, worth of fees. And, you know, once McKinsey gets into a company, they want to stay there and they'll find more work to do. And this will go on for years and years and into the decades, you know, which is certainly the case at some of the big pharmaceutical companies and banks. You can make a strong case that keeping it in-house is actually more cost efficient.
Gotcha. Okay.
We obtained a briefing book, which was given to a lot of the new recruits, in which a senior consultant advised them to get inside and then spread like an amoeba, act like a Trojan horse. You know, once in, search for more business. And that is their MO. And, they check in, but they don't check out that often.
What happened to client over firm?
I'm sorry.
What happened to the client over firm? That was number one value. That doesn't seem too
spread like a virus.
Well, you know, they can interpret that in the way that's most beneficial to them, obviously.
Yeah, that's always nice. Well, so let me ask you this, and let's talk about antitrust a little bit. There was a story in ProPublica recently about a company that had developed an algorithm to tell landlords, largely corporations that owned a lot of housing stock or management companies, how to raise rents. That is a little bit counterintuitive to what a landlord would do, and certainly more heartless than landlords. And it found that over the course of X number of years, rents have gone up exponentially because of this algorithm. And there was some question about it being an antitrust issue, because if you replace the words, algorithm with, a guy named Bob, if the guy named Bob tells all of these people who own all these apartments, raise the rents, there's some collusion there. There's some price fixing. How is there an antitrust issue associated with, McKinsey people entering into an industry, even though they're going for competitors? If they're all following a certain approach, does there become antitrust implications there, Michael?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And where you could see that, playing, out is, because McKinsey advises multiple companies in the same industry. So take something really simple, like the auto industry. So if McKinsey's, advising GM and Ford, and Chrysler, or whoever owns Chrysler these days, often a company is going to hire McKinsey because it wants to know the best practices in the industry. It wants to know what's going on among its competitors. And of course, what it'll get is a sanitized PowerPoint slide deck that anonymizes the competitors. But oftentimes, it's not that hard to figure out, what's going on. So in that sense, McKinsey really is the glue, that binds all these companies together, that passes, knowledge between companies. And this happens, within countries and also globally, because it works, again, for companies in the same industry all over the world. So you can see how McKinsey, could really be a challenge to antitrust, officials, to the antitrust, organization.
And you can begin to understand, if I add this one point, why the same companies in the same space are so willing to hire McKinsey, knowing that their competitors hiring them. Because there's some general knowledge that you're going to get. Now, we're not suggesting that McKinsey, is advising them to set prices at this or set prices at that. But there is a, you know, certain, you know, you hire these consultants because they supposedly know stuff. And some of the stuff they know is what what competitors are doing. And so I think that is one incentive for them to go along with this sort of what some people would think a strange relationship where, you know, they come to the Washington Post to tell them how to beat the New York Times and they tell the New York Times how to beat the Washington Post. I think that's kind of nutty, but that's how they make their money.
But also, to be clear, they're also in that illustration, they're also telling them how, in many respects, to fleece would be my word, their customers, right? Like the success of these companies don't necessarily always have to be mutually exclusive to their competitors. It can be at the expense of customers, of workers, of communities. Like, hey, you know, guys, we're not going to tell you trade secrets from this company, but we will tell you this, that there seems to be a lot of lack of enforcement when you dump this stuff into a river type of thing. And you know, the anti-competitiveness elements are one part of it, but it's also, here are some just general things that we've learned about how you can abuse, you know, where there's weaknesses in our government regulatory system. So with that said, Walt, what if I was inclined, if I became, you know, president or, you know, let's say, or a dictator, and I was interested in regulating this, like under what auspices, where could I regulate? I mean, I can see some problems with like, hey, you know what? I don't want McKinsey working for our semi, you know, conductor chip manufacturers and then going and working for, you know, Chinese ones necessarily. Like there may be some national security issues that I have, and there seems to be some framework for that. I don't know that it's exercised at all. But what else could we do domestically to say like this type of consulting is fundamentally problematic for American society, and under the auspices of these statutes or this, we're going to regulate in some fashion.
Well, we could begin with more disclosure and more transparency so that the public can see what they're doing and could judge it and could, you know, make suggestions and criticize it. That's where you begin. And that could lead then to government deciding whether there are proper ways to oversee these guys. I think it's strange that, you know, with that kind of power, that the government has shown no interest in overseeing them. I guess I can understand.
I mean, is it strange? Like Cotton, right? Was a McKinsey guy. Buttigieg is a good McKinsey guy. I mean, we don't even know. It's quite possible there may be others that we're not even aware of on some level, right?
Maybe you worked for McKinsey, possibly. Who knows? We don't know that.
But when you say more transparency, do we have any type of regulatory or statutory basis in which to say to McKinsey, can the FTC go to McKinsey and say, like, we need to have more disclosure? Could the SEC go and say, are they a publicly traded company? I mean, how would we go about to get that level of transparency? Or is it just like, please, guys, tell us more? Or do we need it from folks like you?
I mean, there is some transparency. It's just, it's really hard to sort through. And that's when, you know, if there's a government contract and McKinsey's getting a government contract, then there are, you know, there is some level of disclosure. But, you know, Walt and I have been trying to get more information from, you know, more visibility on what it's doing with the government for years. It's really hard. And it's not just a problem in the United States. This is a problem around the world in McKinsey's work, you know, with governments around the world. So that's really difficult to get in, even with government work, you know, to understand, you know, what exactly McKinsey's doing with all these agencies.
It's sort of surprising it's not a, you know, a topic of more conspiracy talk, because this type of like lack of transparency and this type of sort of reach, you'd expect, you know, Alex Jones should be working on this.
Pardon me. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, is there any, outside of relying on investigative reporters, is there any other mechanism that we have to get more transparency for a company that has this type of broad-based influence in our economy and our national security. I mean, never mind what's happening internationally.
I don't know. I haven't investigated the solutions. We had enough trouble just trying to identify the problems. We do know that it took journalists, Mike, me, and ProPublica, and other, you know, terrific investigative reporters from South Africa to the United States to expose what these people are doing and to expose their power and to show how they affect our lives. So, you know, how do you regulate them? I think not first you begin with a little more transparency, a little more disclosure, and then you have public hearings and solutions are designed. I want to make one other point about healthcare. They are involved in virtually every step, every link in the healthcare delivery chain. And I think that alone is scary and wrong, from the doctors and the hospitals to the drug companies, to the distributors, to the managed care, to the payers, to the Medicaid, to the government payers. That is crazy, that kind of a authority and that kind of power. And, you know, and a lot of that, a lot of the government contracts, I should point out, and then I'll shut up, is they're, you know, no bid. No competitive activity going on. So, you know, they've got the inside track and they take the advantage of it.
Well, it's a fascinating story, important for people to understand. And hopefully maybe somebody out there will be inspired to come up with, like, you know, maybe it's a smaller piece on just like how we regulate this company, because it seems to be a massive problem. And you guys have, like, I don't know, it's like it's like a Da Vinci Code story on some level. Walt Bogdanich and Michael Forsyth, investigative reporters, both at the New York Times. The book is When McKinsey Comes to Town, The Hidden Influence of the World's Most Powerful Consulting Firm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Well, there it is. We're going to take a break and head into the fun half of the program. We're going to be spend a little time talking about the meltdown that's happening on the Republican side.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of people who thought this was going to be a massive victory for Republicans, both in the House and the Senate. There was a lot of people who were convinced that finally the American public was going to get the opportunity to weigh in on the gender identification of people they don't even know.
The stinking wokeness.
And we will talk about that and more. And, you know, soon we'll move into the sort of the next iteration of what's going to happen in the lame duck session. But we need to know who's going to control the House, because that's going to have broad implications as to what the Democrats feel they need to get done over the next 4 weeks, I guess. Tomorrow on the program, we should just tell you, we've got, who's it, Mark Stern tomorrow?
Yes.
We're going to be talking to Mark Joseph Stern, court reporter at Slate.com. And there's a couple of really important Supreme Court cases that were either decided or argued over the past couple of weeks that we didn't really pay as much attention to because of the midterms. We're going to talk to him about those. And then we will do a little bit more election stuff on Wednesday, talking to Ari Berman. And we may talk to Aaron Kleinman, too, to get a sense of what's happening across the states. Great story in terms of the states, too. I mean, great relative to what you would expect in an off-year election.
Oh, yeah.
And so
Michigan and Pennsylvania, too, just like massive swings for the Democrats on the state level as
yep.
well.
In yeah. fact, yesterday on the street, I think it was yesterday, I walked by a guy on the street who had worked for two state races in Pennsylvania that flipped.
Wow.
So that was fun. You know, you walk by somebody and they're like, oh, hey, and, you know, they're excited to see you. And then I was like, wait a second, I'm excited to see you. You just made a huge difference in our politics. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. It was after my haircut. He didn't say anything about it. It was right after my haircut. It's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at the at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help this show survive and thrive, but you also get the free half free of commercials, and then you get the fun half. So it's a huge win. Like I say, it's like a win-win-win-win-win. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Great folks out in Madison, Wisconsin. Real movement partners. Emma, today is Monday.
Yes.
What do we got?
So today on ESVN, we will be having a guest on. Nando Vila will be joining us to talk about the World Cup and educating me on that. Probably we'll dive into some of like what the fire festival type conditions that have gone viral in the like fan villages outside of the World Cup, what the broader implications of that are, as well as...
It's in Qatar, right?
Yeah. With much controversy. So we'll be talking to Nando about that. That'll be later in the show, but earlier we will be breaking down a very wild and fun NFL Week 10 and talking a lot, I think, about the Minnesota Vikings. And yeah, Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, not done yet. We wrote them off, but they ain't wrote back, as Geno Smith would say. So yeah, check us out, youtube.com/ESVN show. Although we will be streaming on the Majority Report channel today, but this might be, we're phasing that part out.
We're going to work on that green screen, get that logo going.
Yes, we'll that see. Too. That too. So
big
check
things
that out.
Happening around here, folks. Mm-hmm. Big, big, big.
Big.
Huge. Matt. What's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe? The MLU.
Oh, God, I hate that.
Yeah.
tomorrow, well, we have a think tank up for patrons at patreon.com/leftreckoning released this weekend. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with Nick from the Debt Collective about the status of the student loan cancellation, and also Ryan Zickgraff of the Coal Creek War, one of the largest insurrections in American labor history. That's tomorrow. Patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that. Oh, and in the post game, we're going to be viewing the Tucker Carlson's documentary about Blake Masters. I've taken we're going to look back at that and see how a candidate could be so bad.
Did you see the ad that he did about abortion?
No.
I got that. It is. You got to include that. It's insane.
You saw the gun one where he said this gun was made in Germany two different times.
Oh, yeah,
minutes.
The Walter PPK? Yeah, no.
This gun was made in Germany.
Gun. Yeah. Like, he's got these, like, James Bond fantasies.
Yeah.
That dude's twisted. I also read today that he was, when they did a focus group on him, they found him the most unlikable candidate ever that they had tested.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
So thank you, Peter Thiel. You know, the best part about all of those libertarians, and I mean all of them, every single one of them, I'm including, you know, whether it's Peter Thiel or Walter Block or, you know, even like that guy who's not a bad guy. I mean, nice guy, but, you know, libertarian Adam against the world. Whatever. Do you remember that guy? No, maybe that's not that right. And not Adam Collins. Mm. No, the guy who got arrested at the Lincoln Memorial had him on. He ran for a libertarian.
I forgot.
I can't remember. Or, you know, even like someone like Glenn Greenwald. Mm-hmm. They have no sort of concept of just how, like, when they start to lay out their vision for society, They either have no concept of how normal human beings respond to it, because, I mean, and that's, you know, that's why people enjoy these debates, because I don't really do much. I just let them talk and guide them to what is really the essence of what they're saying. And then when they do that, everybody just listens to it and go like, I can't believe that guy actually believes that. And then sometimes I'll say like, you know, the American public is going to have a hard time with that. And you go, and they'll say, well, that's the problem.
Right.
Is that the American public just doesn't understand what's good for them. And so they don't. And this isn't like, hey, man, you shouldn't have saturated fats. All right. You're not a doctor. But so you don't realize that maybe those are bad for you. This is like, hey, you think you want democracy. And that's just like not the way things should work. Trust me. I, you know, read Ayn Rand, and so I should know what's happening.
I love that all the guys who definitely weren't rooting for the Republicans are now like, isn't it weird that election totals take so long? You don't blame people for having questions.
It is odd because those questions were not extended to, say, like elections in Bolivia, for example, where there was an understanding of how that process worked.
Yeah, I mean, we also like remember 2000.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to I got one IM I want to read. I can't disclose my name, but I'm a former McKinsey employee. Understand that. I listened to today's interview with abject amazement. You had a great panel, and they got – well, they've been investigating this for 5 years. You had a great panel, and they got the analysis very, very right. Happy to discuss on email to share more insights. Yes, by all means, please do. Meanwhile, did you realize that you have the same sponsors as Matt Walsh and Ben Shapiro in Kamakoto Knives? It's a bit disturbing. Can you relook at that? I'm surprised that that's the only sponsor that we would have in...
Those guys used to do Harry's until Harry's did something woke.
And then they did a different razor?
Now they have Jeremy's razors, Jeremy Boring. You haven't heard of it. It was a bit. They did this whole thing like, we're going to do the anti-woke razor.
I would think there's got to be... Harry's. I would think there's got to be more overlap than that, too. I mean...
Yeah.
Yes, we exist in like a society, so we're going to have advertisers that we share with people that we don't, that we make fun of.
I don't know. Brokers.
I mean... I can assure you, like, I can understand that the problem would be like, hey, you know, is it right for you to take money from the Mercers when they're giving, when they're, you know, well, I would be a little bit, I would think it would be a little bit problematic if we took money from the Mercers, because presumably if they're going to give us like $10 or $11 million or whatever it is that they gave, you know, the Daily Wire or any of these outlets or something like that. Yes, I can understand why that might be an issue, because you'd be like, hey, is that influencing your content? But none of our sponsors, how do you even say like Sunset Lake CBD does, other than like the fact that like we will do promotions with them to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had the coffee co-op people on in the past and want to do that again. But I you know, it's full disclosure, when we have the coffee people on from the co-op, we're there to promote, not, you know, I mean, it promotes the coffee, but it also promotes the idea of a co-op. And so it's done with full disclosure. The idea that we're getting money from the same company that makes whatever it is, soap, compostable bags, knives, toothpaste, whatever it is, I don't understand what the issue is with that at all. I mean, we also get paid in the same currency.
We did not ask for our payment in crypto, right? Which might be a bit different. I mean, we might share one sponsor with some of those shows because we're also a political show. So I guess that they go out to the same kinds of people. But we're not selling a lot of what they're selling, which would be, I would guess, crypto, reactionary stuff. Like,
yeah, I think they're, you know, people can take issue with like, you shouldn't sell, you know, well, and we don't. You know, I won't do anything that has to do with financial services. I certainly won't do anything that has to do with gold. I certainly won't do anything that has to do with gig economy. And look, we reject sponsors all the time. We've had multiple times where we've dropped sponsors. Multiple times. Sometimes sponsors with products that I like, and because of some of their business practices, we drop them because I don't agree with their business practices. Sometimes because products turn out to not to be, you know, sort of like, you know, we get bad reviews on the products, that type of thing. So, but in terms of like the idea that other people are advertising for them.
Knives aren't ideological. I think that's the answer.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that could have been done much easier. Thank you, Matt.
Yeah.
Speak up a little bit earlier. Next time we
circling
don't have to
the drain
again.
On this.
Yeah. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Bring back DJ Dinner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Come on. Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.